In chapters 40 to 48, you have description of a vision which Ezekiel receives. I think something that's different here from previous visions is that, because Ezekiel has had many visions through his book, but previous to this, when Ezekiel had visions, they were explained to him. We looked in our last session at the vision of the dry bones, and he has this vision of dry bones coming to life and putting on flesh. But God says in 37:14, in the context of that vision, I am going to raise up again the people of Israel and breathe new life in them. So you have an indication, at least, of what the vision is intended to depict. Earlier in the book, he had a vision of the wickedness of Jerusalem and things going on in Jerusalem. Remember, he was in Babylon. But the Lord then says, I'm going to punish Jerusalem for their wickedness. I'm going to destroy the city of Jerusalem. But when you come to 40 and following, you have this vision that's given, and I think quite clearly it's given as a unit from 40 all the way through to 48. But there's no explanation with it as to what it means. And of course, that's part of the reason for differences of interpretation of significance or meaning. But I think that's reason in itself to go slow about jumping to conclusions on exactly what its meaning is. We're going to look at some of the alternatives as we progress here. But notice on your outline, one under 40 to 48 is content of chapters 40 to 48. I have three subpoints under that. Chapters 40 to 43 is the same as what's on the screen there. 40 to 43 is description of the visionary temple. 44 to 46, description of the worship of the visionary temple. And 47 to 48, boundaries and division of the land in Ezekiel's vision. So I think the material divides pretty well into those three sections. There's a great deal of material here, and there's an awful lot of detail. If you read through it, in these first three chapters, let's look at A first, 40 to 43. Every small feature of the future, or this visionary temple, is described and measured. You see the way it begins. In the first five verses, you read, in the 25th year of our captivity, in the beginning of the year, in the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was smitten, so you're 14 years after Jerusalem has fallen, on the very same day, the hand of the Lord was upon me, brought me there. In the visions of God, he brought me into the land of Israel. So, in a visionary situation, Ezekiel is brought to Israel. Set me upon a high mountain on which was a structure like a city on the south. And he brought me there, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of bronze, with a line of flax in his hand and a measuring reed, and he stood in the gate. So here's a man with a measuring instrument. And the man said to me, Son of man, behold with thine eyes and hear with thine ears, set thine heart upon all that I shall show thee, for to the intent that I might show them unto thee, art thou brought here. Declare all that thou seest to the house of Israel. And then what follows is this vision of this temple, and it is measured part by part by this man. Behold, the wall on the outside of the house round about, and in the man's hand a measuring reed of 6 cubits long by the cubit and a handbreadth. So he measured the breadth of the building, one reed, and the height, one reed. So that in verse 5 there, you have this reference to a measuring reed, 6 cubits long. Now, cubits generally thought to be it depends on the long or the short cubit. This says by the cubit and a handbreadth, which would be about 21 inches. A long cubit, but about 21 inches. A short cubit, about 18 inches. this reed, 6 cubits, would be about 10.5 feet long. 10.5 feet long. So apparently this wall was about 10.5 feet high and 10.5 feet wide that this man measures. But you see, as you go down further, verse 6, he came to the gate which looks toward the east and went up in its steps. He measured the threshold of the gate. In verse 8, he measured the porch of the gate. It gives you the dimension. In verse 10, the little chambers of the gate were three on this side, three on that side. And verse 11, he measured the breadth of the entrance of the gate. So you have a very detailed description. People have gone through these details and diagrammed it out so that you have a picture of the structure of Ezekiel's temple. But remember the context. Ezekiel's coming to the land of Israel. He sees in a visionary sense, in a visionary context, this temple. And he measures out all the features of the structure, inside and out. Remember, it's not a building that was in Israel in Ezekiel's day. It's something seen in a vision. Now, I think that suggests either that God was giving Ezekiel ideas in a symbolic form by means of this detailed vision of this temple, or it could mean that there, at some time in the future, would be a building of this type. Those, of course, are the two alternative interpretations, main and alternative interpretations, that this is a vision of something that actually was to be in a literal sense someday, or that this is a symbolic picture of something for the future. When you get down to chapter 42 in this section, verse 15 to 20, you read, "Now when he had finished measuring the inner house, he brought me forth toward the gate, whose prospect is toward the east. He measured it round about. He measured the east side with measuring reed, 500 reeds with measuring reed round about. He measured the north side, 500 reeds with measuring reed round about. He measured the south side, 500 reeds with measuring reed. He turned to the west side, measured 500 reeds with measuring rod. He measured by the four sides. It had a wall around about 500 reeds long, 500 reeds broad to make a separation between the sanctuary and the common place." Now, I read from the King James, but if you look at the NIV, that's 42:15, the NIV says, "When he had finished measuring what was inside the temple area, he led me out to the east gate, measured the area all around. He measured the east side with measuring rod. It was 500 cubits. Instead of 500 reeds, it says 500 cubits. There's a text note here in the NIV. That's verse 16. Oh, it says C Septuagint, verse 17. In verse 17, it says he measured by the north side, it was 500 cubits. And the text note says Hebrew rods, also in verses 18 and 19. So you get a textual problem with this term cubit or reed. And as I'd mentioned earlier, a reed is 6 cubits. So you see, it makes an enormous difference whether you're saying 500 cubits.
"Like the vision I had seen when he came to destroy the city, and like the visions I had seen by the Kibar River, and I fell face down. The glory of the Lord entered the temple through the gate facing east. Then the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. While the man was standing beside me, I heard someone speaking to me from inside the temple. He said, 'Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place for the soles of my feet. This is where I will live among the Israelites forever. The house of Israel will never again defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings by their prostitution and the lifeless idols of their kings at their high places, when they place their threshold next to my threshold and their doorpost beside my doorpost, with only a wall between me and them. They defiled my holy name by their detestable practices, so I destroyed them in my anger. Now let them put away from me their prostitution, the lifeless idols of their kings, and I will live among them forever.'" So what he sees in the vision is a return of the glory of the Lord, Kavod Elohei Yisrael, the glory of the God of Israel. He sees the return of the glory of the God of Israel to the temple. And that comes through the east gate by which it had earlier departed. He had had a vision previously when he had seen all the wickedness going on in Jerusalem. Chapter 10, verse 19 and follows. And you read there in verse 10, 18, and the glory of the Lord departed from over the threshold of the temple and stopped above the cherubim. While I watched, verse 19, the cherubim spread their wings and rose from the ground, and as they went, the wheels went with them. They stopped at the entrance to the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the God of Israel was above them. And if you go down to 11:23, he says, the glory of the Lord went up from within the city and stopped above the mountain east of it. The Spirit lifted me up and brought me to the exiles of Babylon in the vision. So, see, earlier he had seen a vision of the glory of the Lord leaving Jerusalem. Now he sees a vision of the glory of the Lord returning to Jerusalem. And God says that I will live among them forever, among his people. 43:10-12 says something, although it's cryptic enough not to settle the interpretive problem, but it says something about the purpose of the temple that he had seen. See, 10-12 of 43 says, Son of man, describe the temple to the people of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their sins. Describe it so that they may be ashamed of their sins. Let them consider the plan. And if they are ashamed of all they have done, make known to them the design of the temple, its arrangement, its exits and entrances, its whole design, all its regulations and laws. Write these down before them so that they may be faithful to its design and follow all its regulations. This is the law of the temple. All the surrounding area on the top of the mountain will be most holy. Such is the law of the temple. Seems that the temple is an expression of the holiness of the Lord, and that the people are to look at the plan and in this plan get some concept or idea of the holiness of the Lord, and they are from it to measure the pattern. That's the way the King James translates the phrase there in verse, the last phrase of verse 10. Measure the pattern. NIV says, let them consider the plan. It seems that in some way the people are to learn the way of holiness so that they may be ashamed of their iniquity, as verse 10 says, by awareness of the details of the structure and use of this visionary temple. All right, 43:13 and following speaks of the altar. It describes it, measures it. I don't think we need to look at the details of that, but that's down through the rest of the chapter. Question, what do you want?
There be, this is a little
much, well, yeah, I think it's possible. Yeah. These verses have been used to by some who argue for that to support that. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I can't answer that. It's clear that they didn't. There was never a temple that existed in, you know, whether the original one or the rebuilding at the time of the return from exile or Herod's temple that ever followed this particular plan.
I mean, didn't you say in verse 11? If they're ashamed of all that they've done, make known to them the design of the house. Mm-hmm. So, saying we'll observe its full design and statutes and do them.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to say that this is a plan or a follow.
Yeah, it does on the one hand, but on the other hand, you know, there are some elements. If you go to 47, and I think this is all one piece, you have this river that's flowing from the altar down towards the Dead Sea, getting deeper as it goes. How do you do that? See, there are features of this. Some features you could say, well, yeah, why didn't we get Paul? But there's some other features of this that seem to go beyond possibility of construction. I think they tried to copy the pattern of the first, as much as they knew of the first. Just rebuild it. And that brings us to the end of chapter 43, which is the description of the visionary temple and its various parts. I might, if you look in any standard commentary, you'll find diagrams. The Tyndale Old Testament commentary by Taylor has diagrams. This is taken from it. The new Spositor's Bible commentary, the section on Ezekiel, has diagrams. That's just a diagram constructed from the description of the temple itself, and then of the larger temple area with the courtyards and inner court, outer court, the wall around it, the sanctuary itself being here. Come up with diagrams like that. So it can be done. Generally, they look pretty much alike. Let's go on to B, though. Description of worship of the visionary temple. Again, I don't want to look at this in any careful detail, but just get an idea. In 44:1 to 31, you have remarks about the Levites and the priests and the prince. Notice the first four verses. The man brought me back to the outer gate of the sanctuary, the one facing the east. It was shut. The Lord said to me, "This gate is to remain shut. It must not be opened. No one may enter through it. It is to remain shut because the Lord, the God of Israel, has entered through it." That's that eastern gate. The prince himself is the only one who may sit in the gateway to eat in the presence of the Lord. He is to enter by way of the portico of the gateway and go out the same way. Then the man brought me by way of the north gate to the front of the temple. I looked and saw the glory of the Lord filling the temple of the Lord, and I fell face down. See, those first four verses speak about the closure of the east gate until this prince will come. And there are other references through this section to the prince. And the question is, who is it? You might initially think, well, is that the Messiah? Is that Christ? But it seems clear when you read further that the prince cannot be the Messiah. If you look at 46:2, you read, "The prince is to enter from the outside through the portico of the gateway and stand by the gatepost. The priests are to sacrifice his burnt offering and his fellowship offerings." This prince apparently doesn't have priestly rights. The priest will sacrifice his burnt offerings and his fellowship offerings. That's 46:2. In 45:22, "On that day the prince is to provide a bull as a sin offering for himself and for all the people of the land." He needs to offer a sin offering. 45:22. In 46:16, this is what Sovereign Lord says, "If the prince makes a gift from his inheritance to one of his sons, it will also belong to his descendants. It is to be their property by inheritance." So the prince has sons. Now, Charles Feinberg, in his commentary, who views this temple as a literal temple to be built in the millennial period, feels that the prince is a descendant of David who will represent the Messiah governmentally. Not the Messiah, but some sort of a representative of the Messiah governmentally. Some other commentators suggest that the prince is David himself. I think the identity of the prince is very difficult to come to any firm conclusion on. It seems that he functions in some way as a vice-regent of the Lord in certain functions,
he has certain important functions, but he certainly is to be distinguished from the Messiah. Yeah. No.
What I don't understand is if this is in the millennium period, why do we have a temple with sacrifices?
Well, hold that because I want to discuss that. Yeah. It's a very good question. Probably one of the key questions in this whole section. Yeah. We'll hold that just for a minute. We're in chapter 44. Verses 5 to 9 say no foreigners or aliens are to do menial work in the sanctuary. 5 through 9, no foreigners or aliens are to do menial work in the sanctuary. 10 through 14, the Levites are to function as keepers of the charge of the house. See, 10, the Levites who went far from me when Israel went astray and who wandered from me after their idols must bear the consequence of their sin. They may serve in my sanctuary, having charge of the gates and serving in it. They may slaughter the burnt offerings and sacrifices for the people, stand before the people and serve them. But because they serve them in the presence of their idols and made the house of Israel fall into sin, I have sworn they must bear the consequence of their sins. They are not to come near to me as priests or to come near any of my holy things or my most holy things. They must bear the shame of their detestable practice. But I will put them in charge of the duties of the temple and all the work that is to be done in it. So the Levites, who were responsible for much of the declension in Israel and the sin of Israel, are here keepers of the charge of the house. They do menial tasks, but they're excluded from the higher priestly functions, which are given in verses 15 to 17 to priests in the line of Zadok. See 15, the priests who are the Levites and descendants of Zadok, who faithfully carried out the duties of my sanctuary when the Israelites went astray from me, they are to come near to minister before me. Zadok had been faithful to David during Absalom's rebellion. And he had anointed Solomon king after the attempt of Adonijah to take the throne. And the descendants of his line will be the priests in this temple. 28 to 31 of 44 is provision for the sustenance of the priests, how they will be provided for through offerings and so forth. In 45 to 46, you have descriptions of the offerings and sacrifices and holy days that are to be observed. I won't go through the details of that, but you have a detailed description of that. Let's go on to C, 47 to 48, boundaries and division of the land in Ezekiel's vision. And let's begin with 47, first 12 verses, because this is the Temple River. The man brought me back to the entrance of the temple, and I saw water coming out from under the threshold of the temple toward the east. For the temple faced east. The water was coming down from under the south side of the temple, south of the altar. He then brought me out through the north gate, led me around the outside to the outer gate facing east, and water was flowing from the south side. As the man went eastward with a measuring line in his hand, he measured off 1,000 cubits, and then led me through water that was ankle deep. He measured off another 1,000 cubits and led me through water that was knee-deep. He measured off another 1,000 and led me through water that was up to the waist. He measured off another 1,000, but now it was a river that I could not cross because the water had risen and was so deep enough to swim in, a river that no one could cross. He asked me, "Son of man, do you see this?" Then he led me back to the bank of the river. When I arrived there, I saw a great number of trees on each side of the river. He said to me, "This water flows toward the eastern region, goes down into the Arabah, where it enters the sea. When it empties into the sea," Arabah would be Dead Sea area. It enters into the sea, the Dead Sea. "The water there becomes fresh. Swarms of living creatures will live wherever the river flows. There will be large numbers of fish because this water flows there and makes the salt water fresh. So where the river flows, everything will live. Fishermen will stand along the shore from En-Gedi to an Eglaim, and there will be places for spreading nets. The fish will be of many kinds, like the fish of the Great Sea." The Great Sea is the Mediterranean Sea. But, his qualification, the swamps and marshes will not become fresh. They will be left for salt. Fruit trees of all kinds will grow on both banks of the river. Their leaves will not wither, nor will their food fail. Every month they will bear, because the water from the sanctuary flows to them. Their fruit will serve for food, and their leaves for healing. So you have this interesting picture of this river. The waters begin at the altar of the temple, the visionary temple, and they go from the temple, and there's this man measuring the depth, and as he goes eastward, 1,000 cubits, that's about 1,500 feet, the waters come up to his ankles. And then 1,500 feet further downstream, the water's to his knees. And another 1,500 feet, and they're up to his hips. Another 1,500 feet, and it's over his head. You have to swim in it. Now, what's interesting is the growth of the river seems to be unexplainable. It begins as a small stream issuing out of the temple. It's ankle deep. But at every quarter of a mile, it gets deeper and deeper until it's a large river. It's a rather strange phenomena. There's no suggestion of tributaries coming in. It's just that the volume seems to increase the further it goes. So in some unexplained way, this water increases the further away it gets from the altar of the temple. And then when you read a bit further, verses 9 to 12, it says that there are trees on the sides of the river, and the waters have a healing quality. And, of course, you can ask, what is the point of all this? How are we to understand this? Is this to be taken literally or symbolically? Is this descriptive of a physical change that's going to take place that would enable a phenomenon like this to occur? Why all the detail about the growth and depth and the trees and the healing quality of the river, of the water? I think when you read this, you can't help but think of the similarity, at least. It's not identical, but of the similarity with Revelation 22. Where John is shown a river of the water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. Certainly the imagery is similar. So we might ask, in Ezekiel as in Revelation, is there something that is symbolically depicted by this flow of this river? Notice in Ezekiel, it's not a complete victory that the river accomplishes. In other words, the picture here I don't think is like the one you find elsewhere in the prophets, where it says that righteousness will cover the earth as waters cover the sea. This isn't universal, the effects, because it says the miry places and the marshes will not be healed. That's verse 11. So it's not everything that's going to be healed or made fresh. Now, as far as interpretation, let's hold off on that till we get kind of to the end of this and try to come to some conclusions. But subsequent to that, in 47, you have descriptions of boundaries of the land for the different tribes and for the land as a whole. And it's a rather remarkable description as far as boundaries are concerned. Thought I had a transparency here. This is taken from Alexander's commentary in the Expositor's Bible. That's pretty much what Israel will look like according to these boundaries. Now, you notice, one thing. The extent of the land. Here's Damascus. This thing's going way above Damascus.
sure that this kind of a vision, this kind of a vision in present political climate in the Middle East is not helpful to solving the disputes over there. But the tribes, instead of being Gad and Zebulun, for the way down here in the south, Simeon, Benjamin, Judah, Reuben, Ephraim's way up here, east of Sea of Galilee, Manasseh, Naphtali, Asher, Dan. So quite a radically different description of boundaries. And then it also describes provisions for the prince and for the priests and the Levites. And you get a thing like this. Here in the center of the land, see this area? That P stands for the prince's portion. You get a thing like this. Territory of the prince, the priest's portion, Levite's portion, city land, sanctuary. But again, moving from the Jordan to the Mediterranean, straight across. Like that. So, in these, see that runs all the way down through chapter 48. So in these nine chapters, 40 to 48, you have a picture, starting with a picture of a temple. It's all visionary. Then worship in the temple, and the kinds of sacrifices that are to be brought. A gate preserved for the prince, kept closed until he comes. And then this great river that begins at the sanctuary and goes out. And finally, division of the land. So that brings us to the question of interpretation. What is this all about? I think maybe we ought to take our 10-minute break, and then we'll come back, and remaining time we'll talk about interpretation. The first